From St. Luke chapter 23. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. In Jerusalem, there is a memorial to the 6 million Jews of the European Holocaust. It's called Yad Vashem, and if you ever go to Jerusalem, it's one of the things you absolutely must see. I've been there twice, and the experience is life-changing. Yad Vashem outwardly looks like a museum, but inside it's more like a shrine. It's a deeply sacred space. And as you enter, you are drawn into a profound silence. The sights and sounds leave you speechless. You pass through galleries of photographs impossible to describe. The artifacts and memorabilia of organized slaughter begin to empty your mind and your soul. I remember turning a corner and coming face to face with a single tiny shoe of a 2-year-old child that had been retrieved from the gas chambers in Dachau. My first daughter was exactly that same age at the time, and I suddenly couldn't stop the tears from flowing. I thought about those innocent children huddled together for the last time with their agonized parents under the hissing pipes. It's easy to speak about forgiveness in the abstract. It's so very different in practice. How do we forgive these crimes of history? What do we say in our sometimes easy Christian piety to the survivors of Holocausts whose lives are forever scarred and damaged? Forgiveness is no easy matter when it's my child or your spouse whose life is altered by a drunk driver, or a pedophile, or a lone wolf terrorist on a city street. We should not be romantic here. Jesus was in agony, and he found the strength to forgive the people who were killing him. Forgiveness in these circumstances requires unimaginable courage. How can we forgive those who shoot children in schools? How can we forgive those who damage innocent people to further their political or religious causes? How can we excuse people in positions of trust and care, including the church, who devastate the lives of innocents? There are many victims in our world today, many lives destroyed by greed and bigotry and prejudice. How can we match the strength of such overwhelming evil? What force or power in our world can possibly triumph against all its wickedness and cruelty? The message of the Christian gospel is that forgiveness can. God's forgiveness can overcome every evil. The trouble is, when we're consumed with malice and bitterness, we can become victims of our own darkness. We can lose our own humanity. In the grace of God, there is a strength greater than evil, greater than any darkness. The greatest of the gifts of the Spirit, we are told, are mercy and love, which bear all things, believe all things, hope all things, and endure all things. St. Paul in the letter to the Romans says, "Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. If your enemies are hungry, feed them. If they are thirsty, give them something to drink. for by doing this you heap burning coals upon their head. Oscar Wilde said something with a little more sarcasm. Always forgive your enemies, he said. Nothing annoys them so much. Pain and tragedy easily overwhelm us, and the experience can easily entrap us or those we love permanently in a condition of bitterness and resentment. Genuine healing is long and difficult, and there are no shortcuts. And one of the steps is forgiveness. Forgiveness, without denial, is one of the most crucial steps toward healing. It's one of the hardest lessons of life, and one of the most necessary. Thomas Fuller, an Anglican divine, wrote, "He that cannot forgive others breaks the bridge over which he himself must pass." Often people go through life damaging others without thought or care, until one day they damage someone they love. Sometimes this is the only way people can find out. And then they are driven to their knees in repentance. None of us is free from evil, not even deliberate and malevolent evil. And until we recognize this in ourselves, until we have a contrite heart, we are unable to receive the divine courage, which alone can drive it away. From St. Luke chapter 23. Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. I'll never forget a heartbreaking night I spent in hospital with a family whose young daughter was dying of leukemia. We were gathered around the bedside in the kind of aching silence that no words can fill. The father lovingly held his daughter's hand as life slipped away from her. She seemed asleep for a long while, but all of a sudden she opened her eyes and asked him, "Will I see you again? Will I see you again?" How can we bear final separation from those we love? Absence is always a hardship of sorts, of course, but the thought of eternal separation, never again to hold or be held, never again to hear and feel the words of love, the prospect of a cold, empty death is more than most souls can bear, and certainly a young soul. On Good Friday, the thieves on each side of Jesus being crucified with him fell into a dispute with each other. One of them sneered at Jesus, but the other rebuked him. "At least we're getting what we deserve," he said, "but this man has done nothing wrong." And then with his last breath, he asked Jesus to remember him in the kingdom of God. We don't know what prompted this honesty in a dying thief, this confession of truth. Perhaps like many who suffer punishment, he was not really a bad person. Perhaps faced with his last moment of life, he wanted to utter a word of hope. Hope is the most pure of human virtues. It is the most defining. Hope makes us who we are. It raises us above the merely instinctual nature of many species. To speak a word of hope in the face of death is a great act of faith. The writer to the Hebrews says, "Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." Being faithful and being hopeful are very close to each other in the spiritual life. If we believe that all things are possible in God, then we refuse to surrender to the forces of inevitability, to the helplessness of fate. As the old saying goes, if you believe it, you'll see it. To this last breath from the person dying next to him, Jesus says, "Today you'll be with me in paradise." Human hope is met by divine promise. He once said, "From before the foundation of the world, I have loved you, and I shall love you beyond the grave and into eternity." This is a promise on which to stake your life, and especially your death. In the hospital that night, the father took his daughter's hand and said, "Of course you'll see me again. Just wait for me a little while on the other side, and we'll be together very soon." And his daughter died peacefully in the comfort of a strong hope. from John chapter 19. Woman, behold your son. Son, behold your mother. There's this extraordinary moment during the crucifixion of Jesus that's only told in John's gospel. Jesus looks down and sees his mother standing at the foot of the cross with John the disciple. They are speechless with pain. But Jesus says to Mary, "Woman, behold your son," and to John, "Son, behold your mother." Even in the moment of his death, Jesus is building new relationships, giving people into each other's care so they can support one another through life and especially through grief. There is a magnificence about Jesus' death in the sheer simplicity of these words. It lifts his story out of sadness and into glory. Jesus was building community to the very last moment of his life. Community is essential to life. A baby isolated from its mother, even if given food and nourishment, will soon die. An individual cut off from family and friends can slip easily into a subhuman state of mind. Community is life. Community is where we belong. Community is that domain of tensions and challenges and abrasions and harmonies that demands our growth and our spiritual and moral development. Communities can be tough and demanding, but without them, we cannot be human. In 1885, a German sociologist, Ferdinand Tonnies, made the distinction between community and society. It was a time in Europe of the great movement of people from the countryside into the city, from rural life to urban life, from community to society. They are very different things. In communities, we are known. In societies, we are anonymous. In communities, we belong. In societies, we have to join. In the great cities of our modern world, people arrive and mingle from every language and every culture. And one of the things they find is that there are few norms, few commonly accepted standards. Identity is something easily lost or never found. I read recently that at some point in the last 10 years, for the first time in human history, more than 50% of the world's population now lives in cities. And so we need each other. More than ever before, we need places of belonging, people who know us. We cannot love without being loved, and we cannot know ourselves unless we are first known. One of the illusions of the internet and social media is that they can offer us a place to belong, where we can share ourselves and our opinions. But instead, they offer us only an echo chamber where our own voices bounce back to us. In the smaller and smaller circles of like-mindedness where online people live, they find only an unconfronted life. In genuine communities, we are given into each other's care. In Christian communities, we are cared for by the Savior of the world. And Jesus says to us, "You are to love one another as I have loved you. You are my people. You are my church." And the church is simply that, no more, no less, the community of the friends of Jesus, called and given to each other, and all of us standing together at the foot of the cross. from Matthew 27 and Mark 15. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani? My God, why have you forsaken me? We're in now the final stages of Jesus' death. The sun is scorching his body, and his soul begins to withdraw from the world. He leaves behind his mother and his friends standing below, and he enters that private interior place of desolation, that dark place of complete abandonment. Life is a journey we can only make with others, but death is a journey we have to make alone. In all the Bible, there is only one place where we hear Jesus speaking in his original Aramaic language. The Bible has preserved this moment of his deepest pain without any translation. Perhaps it's too sacred a moment. Perhaps the agony in the words speak for themselves. Whatever the reason, we can still hear them with piercing clarity across the centuries. And it's a cry that confirms Jesus' real humanity. Christian faith teaches that Jesus was both divine and human, both spirit and flesh. But sometimes in the tradition, the stress has been so firmly on his divinity that people have come to think of Jesus as a kind of disembodied spirit, someone not like us, not susceptible to our trials and sufferings, impervious to torments. But this cry of desolation from the cross is a cry of authentic and terrifying abandonment, a real person entering real death with no rescue at hand. Why have you forsaken me? He asks. His self-assurance is now gone. His faith is stripped away, and he's alone with the silence of God. An African writer, Tuthumi Ntebini, writes this: what differentiates Christ from Socrates or from us is his embrace of God's incomprehensible silence as a symptom of love and not abandonment. Christ's character and words give assurance that he knows something more than we do. Well, with respect, I disagree. I can find nothing in this cry of despair that suggests anything other than abandonment. No assurance of something more than we ourselves could know. All knowledge has left him now. He's alone without consolation in the naked, empty moment that no words can gloss over. What is true in my African friend's comment is the reference to God's incomprehensible silence. Sometimes in the depths of our deepest need, God says nothing. Sometimes in the dark night of the soul, there is no sound at all. Perhaps it's because we cannot know what words mean until we know silence. Perhaps it's because God has also surrendered the moment and made the decision not to intervene. We cannot know. We are in the space where reason has nothing to say. This is the space of pure surrender. From John chapter 19, I thirst. We have in this cry from the cross yet another sign of the humanity of Jesus. He was dry and parched and very near death. All the Gospels record that they gave him something to drink at that moment, though not water, not something cool to ease his suffering, but vinegar. They wanted to make his death as cruel as possible. They gave a dying man vinegar to drink. Thirst isn't just a physical state, of course. It can also be a spiritual and psychological condition. Jesus' soul had dried up. His inner being had become arid and lifeless, and God had left him. The spiritual strength from which he had forgiven his tormentors earlier had now left him too, and now he had to suffer a further indignity to his body. Spiritual dryness and aridity is a common consequence of physical suffering. The human soul loses hope and falls into despair at the very moment when the body needs spiritual and emotional strength to cope with pain. We are aware now more than ever before of the profound link between physical and spiritual well-being. Our bodies and our souls are inextricably linked. The suffering of one causes damage to the other. Physical healing greatly depends on having a positive spiritual attitude. Aridity of the soul is therefore quite dangerous. It can affect everything, including our relationships. When we enter a wilderness of the spirit, things often spiral downwards and out of control. Some men, in their isolation and loneliness, turn to pornography. Some women turn to compulsive eating or shopping. And they both find that they've been given vinegar to drink. The thirsty, parched soul reaches out for comfort and finds only bitterness. We all thirst. We all thirst for the true and living things of life, the water that flows from the deep well springs. There's a beautiful story in the Bible where Jesus meets a woman at a well. They are both thirsty, but his thirst is physical, and hers is deeply emotional. They both quench each other's need. She fills her bucket and gives him water from the well. He heals her soul with the living water of forgiveness and love. Human bodies and spirits cry out for healing. And that is why throughout the ages, mystics and saints, gurus and scriptures in many traditions point us to the deep wellsprings of God, the profound, life-giving waters of the Spirit. Renewal and joy are to be found deep in the mystery of God, deep in that love which is at the heart of the universe. And to this love, Jesus is now very near. from John chapter 19. It is finished. One of the interesting things about these final words is that Jesus didn't say, "I am finished," which is what you might expect, as in, "I'm done, it's all over for me." Jesus didn't say that. He said, "It is finished." Third person. So what's the "it"? Christian tradition has readily supplied the answer. We call it the work of the cross. Jesus was sent by God to complete a task, to redeem humanity, to save the world, the creation. And there are various theories about how Jesus did this. He took upon himself the sins of the world, is one theory. He reversed the rebellion of Adam in the Garden of Eden, is another theory. He offered himself as a blood sacrifice to satisfy the requirements of a judgmental God, is another. There are many theories of what we now call the atonement. Is this what Jesus meant? The atonement is finished. I did my job. I redeemed humanity. I can go home now. God will give me a great welcome. The lesser read of John Milton's great epic poems, Paradise Regained, is about this: Jesus returning home in glory, the rejoicing of heaven, the hero's feast and celebration. All these theories, of course, came much later, long after Good Friday, long after Jesus uttered these almost last words and gave up his spirit. It's hard to imagine that these theories were in his mind at the time. It's hard to imagine that in his exhausted and dispirited condition, he felt moved to make a theological statement. It is finished. It, his life, his taking of breath, his walking in the mountains, his conversations with his friends, his moments of quiet solitude and prayer. No longer will the songs of birds come to his ears or the smell of the morning air. It is now in the third person because he has already become distanced from himself. He is separated now from his body and its life. The soul has begun to depart and gazes back upon the physical shell with growing detachment. This is the moment when Jesus' life is complete, not resolved, just finished. Completion and resolution are not the same thing. I've officiated at funerals where we were in the presence of a resolved life, a life whose ending brings peace and fulfillment despite the grief. And I've officiated at funerals where there's no resolution at all, no sense of fulfillment, no satisfaction at a life well lived. When it is finished is all we can say. It's only God who's never finished. God continues. God alone redeems and resolves what we cannot complete. What we must surrender is what we have left undone. It's important to know that only God has the time to bring all things to their final fulfillment. It never depends ultimately on us. Only God never ends. from Luke chapter 23. Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. The last of the seven words of Christ is about surrender. Even though all sense has now left him, Jesus commends his soul into God's safekeeping at the last. It was and remains the ultimate act of trust. Job, the great tortured soul of the Hebrew Bible, says at one point, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust him." Job's spiritual state, even in the midst of great torment and loss, was so sublime that he accepted his fate and whatever God gave him, including death itself. All the great mystics and spiritual teachers in many traditions emphasize this point. The ultimate and sublime act of faith is surrender before God, surrender before mystery, acceptance with tranquility of our own powerlessness and dependence, casting ourselves finally upon the unknowable. The German philosopher Nietzsche had much to say about this. Nietzsche wanted to free humanity from what he saw as our childish dependence upon God and upon religion. He wanted us to embrace a universe unchained, set loose from its anchor, a cold, empty cosmos where there really is nothing apart from ourselves to give it meaning. A Nietzschean death is a final heroic act of defiance against bleak and meaningless existence, a laughter in the face of extinction, a not going gently into that dark night as the last and ultimate act of human meaning. By contrast, Jesus offers his soul to the giver of life. He surrenders not to nothing, but to God. We all have a fundamental choice here. And it's not really about death, but about life. If we believe we live in a cold, empty universe where nothing awaits, nothing eventually matters, if we deify chance, as some scientists do, if we believe the only act of human meaning is to defy its cosmic absence, to become a sort of stoic hero who rises above adversity through sheer will and independence, if we believe that, then it's a choice that affects everything we are and everything we experience. It is an entirely rational choice, and some indeed make it. And it brings its own consequences. And if we make the other choice, if we commit ourselves to the love at the heart of everything, the love that creates and sustains, that gives us community and places of belonging, the love that waters us in the dry places, the love that even remains silent when words have fled, if we live in that love, then the world is never empty, never cold, never set adrift from its moorings. The world and its creator is always mystery, and therefore always hope, and at the center of it all, always the promise of resurrection.